Hello, and welcome to Millennial 2017, number 34. And this is with Aidan Paladin. So, hello, Aidan. Welcome to the channel. And how would you describe yourself to people who might not have heard of you before?
Hey, how's it going? How would I describe myself? Well, mostly what I do on my channel is I talk about sort of how social science and research involving the social sciences affects politics and the things that, you know, daily happenings, how we relate to them, understanding things through the lens of social science research. Politically, I think, yeah, it's difficult. I change my opinion on that from time to time, but I'd probably call myself a Hobbesian libertarian.
Right, okay. And just so that people understand, you have sympathies with the alt-right, but you don't, you're not part of it and you don't identify with that label.
I sympathize, right? And most of my disagreements come with, I'm not sure how we would implement some of the some of these things that are being suggested in the United States. However, I absolutely do think there are instances in Europe where, well, not only are the concerns of the alt-right very valid, but there, it may be the case that major changes need to be made, actually very likely. So I don't self-identify. I think probably most people would, I think a lot of people would consider me that. Clearly I have been considered that by lots of people. But it's also a major misunderstanding, I think, that happens of what is the alt-right, in that it also comprises all kinds of different people with differing political opinions. There's monarchists and there's fascists and there's people who are more libertarian or anarcho-capitalist. So it's already such a nebulous phrase. I find it almost meaningless, but I just don't self-identify. The very complex nature to lump very leanings together.
I think that the thing that a lot of people would see as evidence that they would use it to link you to the alt-right is race realism. Now, before we went on air, you said that you don't like that term. So why don't you explain why you don't like that term?
The idea that we even have to have this conversation that race exists is, I hate to say, oh, something is common sense. But on this case, it is self-evident. We can see when, you know, two people of similar haplogroups, or two people who are predominantly share African haplogroups, for example, have a child. Child was not going to come out with Asian haplogroups. This is basic heredity. And we find differences in between the way people look, just based on observation. You can see visible differences between races. That alone would be a categorization enough to define differences. We would do the same thing in dogs, which everyone hates that example because they think I'm, and it's not like I'm saying humans are equivalent to dogs, but you wouldn't German Shepherd and say this is the exact same dog. There are clear differences. It doesn't make one necessarily superior or inferior to the other. it does, however, mean that there are differences in aggregate between groups, as there are in all kinds of things. It doesn't just have to do entirely with racial components. It can have to do, yes, with nutrition on some level. People who are starving in aggregate will be different from people who are not. But this is a particular group difference, and we have evidence of other, I mean, for example, Asian people tend to be shorter on average. African people of African descent, really sub-Saharan African descent, tend to have longer legs. These are just differences that are easily observable and quantifiable. So the idea that we would have to pretend that they don't exist is silliness.
It is just silly. I mean, as I've said before, everyone knows what, you know, if you see someone and he's black, you know that he's black. Now, obviously, there are edge cases where they're mixed or a mixed race, whatever. But, I mean, obviously, the categories are perfectly valid. And it's just so ridiculous to say that, well, because there are no absolute clear-cut boundaries between these things, therefore they are meaningless categories. That is just so stupid.
Right. I mean, some of it's taxonomy, in that, you know, what we call races are colloquialisms that define broad groups. Now, as you said, if you tried to put this into a very small box and force it very strict definitions to, along these taxonomic levels, and taxonomy is, of course, sort of arbitrary to begin with in terms of its specificity. Well, then, yeah, it becomes hard to say, well, you can't exactly define this person as this race or that race, but race in general is just the way that lay people refer to these observable differences, and not just observable to the, you know, the eye, but observable through group measurable group differences. The yes, point is, indeed. Yeah, you try to narrow it down, it gets, yeah.
Yeah, you start, I mean, obviously it's a lens that you use at a particular distance. You know, once you're zooming into an individual, you know, of course, the nuances come in. But
absolutely.
Still, it's still perfectly valid to view people from a particular distance, and to discern from that distance that they do indeed fall into categories. One thing that I think people might be interested in is, you mentioned racial, like, visible, physical differences. But what about brain differences? Because I think you are probably more up on this kind of thing than other people. So why don't you go into that?
Well, with all of this, and you mentioned, when you get down into the individual, and it's something that I feel like I'm beating my head into a wall, but it has to be stated every time, because otherwise you will always be taken out of context. All of these observations, these findings, they refer to large swaths of people through statistical analysis of an average or an aggregate. It never refers to any individual person, because when you look at, for example, brain differences, we find that on average, African-Americans, and that's data from the United States, because this is different in other countries, African-Americans tend to be one standard deviation below the mean from white people, who tend to be one standard deviation below the mean of Asians and Ashkenazi Jews. This just means that on average, black people, about 85. Now, there's all kinds of questions about what is IQ, and we can go into that, but it's a huge shit show. Basically, IQ, general intelligence, is just a measure of kind of how good you are at figuring out how things go together, logic, and also how to put concepts together. And it's predictive of other measures of success or being good at other things. This, of course, does not preclude that there can't be a black person or an African-American person with an IQ of 170. That is absolutely a possibility. However, they would fall in the very, very, very highest percentile. It's just a little bit less likely. Still, it's not a determinant of any individual. That's the quick and dirty of it.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, beyond IQ, though, do you know about the sort of average characteristics, the differences in brain structure between the different races?
Yeah, not as much. I know, because I mostly deal with social science, and a lot of IQ is a measure that's used very commonly. IQ and things like GPA, all kinds of other measures are utilized very frequently in the social sciences. So I'm more familiar with that. I am familiar on a lesser extent, so I may know, I don't know as much, that there do appear to be observable sizes and brain size difference, in that I believe sub-Saharan African people tend to have smaller in general cranial sizes, but I could be wrong, so I'm not sure. In terms of the characteristics. In terms of other characteristics, I don't know. I don't know about, like, what parts of the brain light up under certain instances. IQ is the one that I really know anything about.
Right, okay.
And I can't find you the gene on it.
No, that's not necessary. That is another thing altogether. I don't know if you want to go into that,
sure.
The recent drama with the skeptics. But yeah, I'm not sure, because Jean-François Garipi is going to be on after you, so mm-hmm. I'm not sure whether to concentrate on that issue with you or with him, because obviously you've both come under fire from the skeptics. Sorry?
He was involved to a much greater extent than I was, in that he was not only the one debunking all of the videos that it sort of... Well, he and Ryan Falk, but... he was also more of a target than I was.
Yeah, and I don't know why they chose him. It could be his Frenchness. I'm not sure. You know, it's like he's so pleased with himself. He's so smug.
I think it's because I sit in my tiny little corner of YouTube. I'm clearly conservative. I talk about my biases on that, but right wing, but I don't talk about race and stream or something, but I don't make videos about that. It doesn't really interest me, because, well, I mean, we could talk about why it would interest me, because people ask you, what's the point of knowing any of this? Well, first of all, science for science's sake, we should just know things. But also when it comes to how the government functions, for example, the United States spends a massive amount of money, more than many, many other countries, on our education system. And yet, again and again, we have very, very low SAT scores, very, very low scores compared to other countries or homogenous countries. And this is because there is an IQ disparity. And so when you talk about, let's throw more and more money at a pointless cause, why not invest that money in trade schools, things that don't require students to have very more higher IQs to excel and succeed and be happy and prosperous? That is my only interest in it. But yeah, I think it's because everyone who was brought into this, and I talked shit about that first RK selection video and basically posted a bunch of sources. I think that I was pulled out as much as I was because they, or why they hated me so much and continue to, is because I'm more difficult to debunk than some other people who don't have any experience with any of this, from a scientific standpoint. Again, even though I'm not interested particularly, but yeah.
Well, I mean, the RK thing was just ridiculous. Yeah. I don't really want to attack Kraut because he's clearly down at this stage. But since it's come up in the conversation, the people in the alt-right, and it's not a universal thing by any means, but there are people in the alt-right, including myself, who invoke the RK theory simply because it's a useful template, it's a useful heuristic. And as the two things are useful archetypes, to speak about R-types and K-types. So that's all. And the mistake that Kraut made, and I don't know if it was deliberate or accidental on his part, was to assume that we were talking about it in absolute terms, that it was absolutely true that this group are R-type and this group is K-type. You know, it's... No.
No, it is a continuum. And also, it has been assessed, not just... So, although I know that a lot of people in the alt-right are in that sort of sphere who use it as a metaphor, it actually has been assessed. I did a live stream with Tildir where we went over a bunch of the social science research that actually has applied this theory to the social sciences and actually examined more or less RRK selection over time in humans. And what's particularly interesting is that many of the things that you can point to as sort of being the fall of Western civilization in many ways are associated with more R-type behaviors. For example, absence of father figures or sexual risk-taking behavior are all associated with basically what they call this R factor versus K factor. And it's been assessed. We can actually measure it. So,
oh yeah. And another one would be left-wing politics.
Exactly.
R-types don't like competition, and they will happily cheat in competition in order to avoid competition, in order to avoid actually competing. Another thing is they don't like hierarchy and rules for the same reason, because they're not adapted for competing. So any rules are going to get in the way. And again, that leads to, and that would transfer or whatever, translate to just nihilism, basically.
Well, sure. And there's the whole thing is, if you, whether you want to use it as a metaphor or want to look at the data, that was just totally misunderstood in that video. And so I posted a big comment that got deleted, I believe, that had a bunch of citations and things. And I think that's what started it, of just the, oh, I was on the bad boy list.
Well, indeed. Yeah. Indeed. But it's been a very strange experience. Mm-hmm. But the other thing that I don't want to go into it too much because it does feel like it's something that would be better to focus on with
definitely.
JNF. Another thing that we were talking about before we got onto this, and it is sort of related, is the dark triad. Now, this mm-hmm. is a phrase that I think a lot of people have heard, but they might not be familiar with it. So why don't you explain that to people? Because I know that I was wondering what to talk to you about, because as I do with everyone in this set, in Millennial, and I thought, well, she's a psychologist, so ask her about that. And it did actually come up in our conversation. So could you explain the dark triad to people?
Sure. Dark triad so when we talk about psychology, I'm actually a media psychologist and a communication scholar, which apparently has come up as I shouldn't call myself a psychologist. And that's fine.
I'm sorry.
No. It's media psychologist sounds very stupid. or communication scholar. So psychologist is usually shorthand. And I have an undergrad degree in psychology, but not a master's or above. So basically the dark triad, though, is when we think about psychological disturbances or disorders, a lot of times the things that are most likely to come to mind as, you know, most salient are things like depression, bipolar disorder. These are problems that are typically caused by temporary imbalances in brain chemistry. And whether you believe in the use of antidepressants and medication to mitigate these chemical imbalances or think that things like exercise are a more proper way to treat it, these are things that are caused by a measurable chemical issue in the brain. We can actually see it. We can observe it. The dark triad and many other things are personality traits, which means that they're longitudinal. Unlike depression bipolar, you can't really get rid of. But unlike depression or anxiety, something that you can get rid of, traits are very, very hard to do anything about. Basically, we have personality traits and personality disorders in particular last the entirety of your lifespan without some very serious intervening. And even then, it's more coping mechanisms than it is amelioration. So the dark triad is narcissism, psychopathy, and Machiavellianism. So probably seems a little bit straightforward on some of them. Narcissism is, of course, self-obsession, right? And these tend to people who are narcissistic, they can also have personality disorders that coincide with these traits. So people who are highly narcissistic are probably very likely to also be diagnosed with something like histrionic personality disorder. Machiavellianism is this, obviously comes from the prince in the terminology. These people who are high in Mach, though, they are extremely manipulative. Something about manipulating, controlling other people, it's just part of their personality that brings them some sort of fulfillment. And psychopathy, which is different from being a psychopath, but probably you could define relatively similarly. People who are violent, who are cruel, who are just, I guess what we could describe as evil. But again, there's all kinds of reasons that you could have one of these traits. And generally speaking, they are kind of hard to get rid of. It's just part of who you are, unfortunately.
So could you describe each of the three traits?
Right. Narcissism, which is egotism, thinking about the self constantly and having no concern for anyone else. It's just, I am the center of the universe all the time. And then Machiavellianism, again, which is wanting to manipulate, control, and people, again, pretty much consistently, you get something out of being able to pull the strings on others and run the show. Usually, again, with all of these, there tends to be some issues with perceptions of morality and interest in others. It's sort of just all of them are typified by lack of empathy. And then psychopathy is violent behavior, cruelty, and again, lack of empathy.
Right. Okay. Yeah. It's fascinating. For the sake of it, what is the difference between a psychopath and a sociopath?
The terms are actually somewhat meaningless at this point, because we wouldn't use those terms really in clinical diagnosis. And even with the term psychopathy, these would be measured through like sort of personality tests, through a Big Five personality test. We find a lot of overlap between some of these things there, although they're their own measures. People who tend to be high in narcissism are probably also likely to be high in Machiavellianism, but they are distinct from one another. In terms of when people say a psychopath or a sociopath, they could be referring to someone with antisocial personality disorder. They could be referring to somebody with all kinds of things. With antisocial personality disorder is probably the one that sociopath or psychopath are most likely referring to at this point, because like dark triad personality traits, personality disorders are long-term, and it's sort of, even with cognitive behavioral therapy, there's not a whole lot we can do to help people get over that, since it's just sort of part of the self. And there can be, we can't even isolate why it might be. A lot of times it's like attachment style during childhood, perhaps, but sometimes it's just something in your brain that's wired in that way.
Yeah, I remember Theodore Dalrymple writing, he had an article, an essay about this, and he said that, you know, you can have twins and one of them turns out completely normal and, you know, emotionally normal and everything and kind and compassionate. And the other one's, in his words, a psychopath.
Right. Yeah,
so it is a very difficult thing to get to grips with.
Well, because even with twins, you're going to have just, and even with monozygotic twins, in that case, yeah, there is a possibility for some environmental effect that just created a, basically, I talk about this a lot, our brains are essentially big roadmaps with more or less worn down roads or paths between different concepts. And if just certain concepts become too closely associated and utilized over and over again, can totally change the way your mind thinks about things. In the same way, a twin who is exposed to some environmental effects that made a particularly strong connection between concepts, well, then they can end up having a personality disorder or being higher on one of these dark triad traits than their brother or sister. And it's still something that we don't fully understand, at least with personality types and personality disorders.
I see. Another topic I was going to bring up with you is, I'm wondering what you'll think about the validity of this. The Myers-Briggs personality test. Because people ask me a lot what my personality type is on that test. It seems to be something that people are interested in, and I'm interested in it as well, but I've not studied it in depth. Now, what do you think about it?
So Myers-Briggs is one of those things where, again, it seems to have some face validity. It looks like it means something, but it's not a very reliable test in that people, based on their mood, can sometimes have a totally different, or, you know, even the time of day, all kinds of things like this can massively change someone's responses. Now, it can be fairly consistent for other people. It doesn't appear to be very good at predicting much of anything. It looks like it's sort of, Myers-Briggs is kind of like a horoscope in some ways, in that, oh yeah, that does sound like me. And it gives you some sense of self-validation when you read a description of yourself and it sounds valid. However, most of the way that it's utilized is in the workplace in order to see, and that appears to be okay in that you don't want to put a very high extrovert with a very, you know, extreme introvert, because they're just going to be at odds with each other. And same with most of the other factors on the test. If you don't want to put two people together who are just extremely different. Now, maybe if you had several people working together that were on varying levels, you could get perhaps better results out of a variety of ideas. That's the place where I've seen it applied and utilized effectively most often. For the most part, yeah, it's kind of like a horoscope.
Is there any test, sort of personality type system that you find more, you know, valid?
For the kind of tests that you take like that, no. I mean, again, when we look at like, there's the Big Five personality traits, right? And those we do, again, find fairly consistently across people. But for something that is, that's trying to put you in a box in the way that I think Myers-Briggs does. So the big five personality, right? It's openness, agreeableness, extroversion, right? Oh yeah, neuroticism. And then what's the last one? Conscientiousness. And those we do tend to find, and those actually have pretty strong correlations between each other. So like people who are high in agreeableness and conscientiousness are usually pretty low in neuroticism, or very low in neuroticism, and vice versa. So, and then of course, under neuroticism is where we get a lot of the dark triad stuff. So, or the dark triad stuff. But that would, I guess, be the test to take, is take a big five personality test and just see how you kind of score across that, because that does tend to be fairly consistent from my experience.
What's, just out of interest, what's your Myers-Briggs personality type?
INTJ, the autistic one.
And well, are you autistic, or is that a coincidence?
No, I have like mild autism.
Ah, right. I know that in the alt-right, that is, it comes up again and again. INTJ is the most. It seems to be loads of guys in the alt-right, and probably girls in the alt-right are INTJ. As for myself, I'm INFJ, but I'm also, I have done INTP in the past, but that's a while ago. It's very interesting. I mean, I just like it. It is, as you say, there's a danger of, just you put in the answers that you wish applied to you.
Yes.
And then you get the description that you, want to be described as.
Yes, very much. And that's actually, well, there's something in testing we call a social desirability effect, but there's also this acquiescence bias. So it's either, there's a couple ways it can go. One, you can say, this is the type of person I think I should be or that I want to be. That's a social desirability effect. And that could extend to people even in the alt-right. If you think it's normal and desirable for us to be, INTJ, then you might answer questions, it might change the way that you answer questions on a test. Similarly or dissimilarly, you could have, that's sort of an in-group thing, but an acquiescence bias, which would be expecting, answering the way you would expect that you think others, in that instance, usually we use it as to describe the researcher, would expect you or want you to answer questions. All of these affect any type of personality test, and we can do some things to mitigate the extent of these effects, but it's always a concern and a cause of error. For example, a simple one is just something called reverse coding, to make sure that people answer the same question. You basically you take these tests, you'll notice sometimes it'll ask you the same question, but it'll be worded differently. That's to basically double check to see if you were, word it negatively, then if... Right.
Of course.
That can do a little bit to help with some of those effects. But unfortunately, and as we spoke about before, humans are very much tribalistic social animals. So it's very possible you might want to answer along with not just what you think of yourself, but our sense of the self is very much tied to group salience at any given time. What group is particularly defining my sense of self, and therefore how might my group answer this question, or who do I want to be in relationship with my group? This is, again, why I said they're a bit horoscopy.
Right, okay. Somebody's got a question for you from the... Oh, God. Some people are asking, what is your opinion regarding the 14 words?
Okay. I don't... I am not a... I don't see the... I think... 88. I think that a lot of that is LARPing, that is silly and misplaced, but if you want to do it, go ahead. That's fine, I guess. I just think that it's sort of replacing real identity to have this sort of Nazi identity, and I don't think that's useful. It's bad optics, if you want to say that. But
yeah, I don't think the 14 words are necessarily Nazi. They're just...
Oh, no, I'm talking about the 88 part. The 14 words, the 88 part, you do whatever you want. The 14 words, regardless of the guy who came up with them, I don't see any problem with. I actually don't find anything. I don't see, unless your issue is with the, because he was in the Aryan Brotherhood, I think, and like had killed a bunch of people. The guy who coined the 14 words. That, well, if you have an issue with him, that's fine, but I don't understand what about those 14 words, unless you think it's not okay to be white.
Yes, indeed. Well, okay. I won't ask you to say the 14. People are asking me to ask you that. That's not fair. She doesn't identify as alt-right. She's
I just said I don't see anything wrong with the 14 words. That's pretty much that's the same right. thing.
Yes, it is. all right. So here's another question for you. Well, actually, there was something you said there about identity. Mm-hmm. Is this something that you see from afar, that people in the alt-right are in danger of substituting a sort of individual identity for a group one? Is that what you were hinting at earlier?
No, not necessarily, because I don't see a problem with group identity. We have it inherently. I like Dr. Peterson, for example, but I find, although I really liked your video on him where he's been kind of doing silly things lately, but the idea that one can expunge the self of any group affiliation is fundamentally flawed. That we always are looking for group affiliation, and it can be as simple as male versus female, or race, which can be, you know, very contentious for some people, or it could be something like as similar as this person is in the same club as me. We're always seeking group affiliation and identity. Basically, we have this sense of self in the center, what we call me, but it lies in the center of all of our different group affiliations, which can be more or less salient at any given point in time. So sometimes, for example, having a conversation about the alt-right, if you consider yourself alt-right, that identity is going to be more salient and therefore more important or effective of the state of the self, of my perception of myself, right? The idea that we can be completely isolated from the group, I just don't think makes any sense from a psychological standpoint.
Yeah, and it's also a strange thing to desire in the first place. I mean, what is so good about not caring about your group or not having a group? Why is that something to aspire to? This is something that I would like to ask Jordan Peterson that, or any individual. I mean, I know that the common individualist would come up with some stupid answer like, well, you should care more about becoming something than being what you were given. But hopefully Jordan Peterson would come up with something more interesting than that. But I do think I'm skeptical about what he would say.
I guess my problem is I don't see how it's mutually exclusive. I consider myself mostly to be a libertarian. So of course I like freedom and I you know, like the free economy, which are, you know, very individualistic type things, I suppose. But at the same time, it is evolutionarily backward to not want to care for kin and actually openly deny kinship affiliation, because, you know, our species evolved with families caring for families, small groups caring for each other. It's how we got to this point. And I guess I think Dr. Peterson would have a much better answer, but I think the average pure individualist would say something like, we're post-collectivism. We're clearly not. You walk into a room and you identify people by, he has a shirt on, a jersey on from a sport team I like. People do that autonomically. It's a cognitive heuristic.
Mm. Yeah, of course. I mean, they would probably say that we're politically or socially or culturally beyond collectivism. But that's kind of irrelevant if we're not instinctively beyond collectivism. No, because it's still going to come up.
You can't escape it. Look, it comes out of a very basic evolutionary standard, which is to determine you know, fight, flight, freeze. In that, if I see something or someone of the other tribe that's dangerous, it's going to activate my fear responses. However, if I see kin, it's going to, for example, make me more likely to help them in some way. This is, again, people do this. It is as easy as walking into a room and looking around and seeing if someone is wearing the jersey or a symbol of identity. You recognize it instantly.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Okay, I've got some questions for you from the chat now. Here's an easy one. Well, it might not be easy. I don't know. It's a simple one anyway. What's your ethnic heritage? Someone thinks that you've got part Irish.
Yes, I'm Irish, Welsh, and German, predominantly.
Oh.
But my family's been here for, well, both sides now have pretty much been here, except for my grandmother, who's from Wales.
Right.
100 years.
Okay.
They're very, very old Americans. That's why I like America so much.
Okay. Okay, as a libertarian, and this is somebody else's words, as a libertarian, would you grant that libertarianism appeals primarily to whites due to biological or heritable factors?
I've heard that argument, but, I think Ryan Folk mentioned something about that, but I don't think I quite understood. I didn't hear the original comment. I heard Jeff Holliday mock it or something like that. And so I'd like to actually hear the argument about it. Why would that be, though? I'm trying to think about we could talk about what separates white people in some ways from others, from other races. And that's a whole big can.
But what I would say is that different dog breeds have different natures, different characteristics.
Oh, sure. I'm not denying that at all.
Oh, yeah. So therefore, it makes perfect sense that different human breeds would have different characteristics and therefore gravitate towards different political paradigms.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We have seen that different sort of just forms of rule that have taken over different forms of civilization that are, you know, generally have typified different parts of the world. Now, I do think that the cold winters theory helps to explain some of it, but I think it's a bit more complex than that, in that the forward-thinking nature of people who lived in areas, and that's not just white people, you'd also find this in many Asian cultures, and you would find it in people from certain parts of the world, like the Egyptian cultures the Egyptian culture that had to focus their society around the inundation of the Nile. People who have to think forward, think about long-term preparation, tend to behave differently from people who live in more, if you want to call it, our selected abundance all year long.
Well, yeah, and that would be the evolutionary explanation for it. But this guy's saying, just look at any libertarian, just look at the demographics of any libertarian convention, 99% white.
Yeah, well, I don't know. There, at least in the United States, I think there might be some other reasons for that. Again, I started this out by saying I obviously think black people have agency. But at least in the United States, there has been a very massive ongoing campaign to really indoctrinate. And again, I think they can will their way out of this and, you know, in some way. But a campaign to essentially put African Americans into the Democrat sort of plantation. So they don't even think. They don't even consider other political standpoints. No, they don't think they even understand other political standpoints, not because they're inherently too stupid to, regardless of, you know, different aggregates in IQ, but rather because it's also cultural taboo. And as I just said, we're very much a tribal species. So if your entire tribe says you cannot even consider such an idea, it makes it very hard to leave the tribe. It makes you what Goffman called stigmatized.
For sure. Okay, here's another question for you. Are high IQ people more prone to depression?
Yes. Very much from what I've seen. It seems to be that, well, it does seem that more high IQ people tend to be more prone to depression. They tend to be more prone to autism. They tend to be more, or, you know, other types of mental disorders. I'm not sure why. I think part of it might be, at least in terms of the depression and anxiety stuff, is if your mind is always working at a very high level. Now, the human brain is already very taxed, a very taxing organ. That's why, I mean, a large amount of the energy we consume goes to the brain. So if your brain is particularly high energy, I think it just becomes stressful. I think that the amount of processing the left brain is doing constantly, which, you know, I mean, it's also why you see high intelligent people have a much higher substance abuse rate, because nothing helps slow down that left brain than alcohol.
Right. So you think there's a sort of a situation where there's just so much activity that in itself gets them down and low energy.
This is complete speculation, by the way. I don't have any research or evidence on this, but based on what I know about brain structure, yeah, I would think that if you're just overworking your brain all the time, and we can see this in other parts of the brain, that if you get too emotionally stimulated all the time, it actually can cause parts of your brain to shrink or enlarge. So I would surmise, although I don't have the data, that if you're a high IQ person and a high IQ person who uses your intelligence very frequently, yeah, it probably is going to actually make you just overworked, overstressed.
All right, I see. You see, my own explanation for this link, and it's again, it's just a layman's speculation, would be that the higher IQ you are, the more likely you are, the more able you are to tie yourself in knots. And the result of tying yourself in knots is basically depression, because you end up, with analysis paralysis.
Sure. I think that's, very much a real possibility. for example, we find that higher IQ people who go into any field, really, are more prone to imposter syndrome, which is the opposite of Dunning-Kruger, in that people who are very intelligent tend to think they're very stupid. And it's because of... Now, that obviously probably has a very negative effect on the brain and on things like depression, stress, and anxiety.
Right. Okay. Here's a good question. And again, if you've got, here's another one. How come, I don't know what y'all want to make of this. How come black people around the world vote for the left?
there's really poor research. It's some of Rushton and Jensen's, but it's not been replicated, and it was not even Rushton directly. It was some other extrapolation from it that surmised greater proclivity towards R selection, but this has not been proven, so this is really spurious research. It was just a hypothesis, and you're never going to conduct it now, so it's speculation entirely. That people of sub-Saharan African descent, perhaps because they did not come from a region with high scarcity, and therefore tend towards what we call colloquially more R-selected behaviors, vote for these sort of democrat systems that are designed to take care of them in some ways, to provide situations of abundance without leadership or self-determination, sort of. Oof, that sounds bad. But
that's okay. We'll just say that they're more inclined to vote for an abundance of Air Jordans. I don't know if you'll get that Murdoch reference. But there we are. So did you get that reference?
Oh, I love Murdoch.
Oh.
Oh no, this stream's gonna end me. That's okay. I'm already on the list, so whatever.
You're already a person of interest.
Yep. Oh well.
Yeah. All right. So here's one. Oh yeah, here's someone asking, what is borderline personality disorder?
borderline personality disorder is kind of like a mix between histrionic personality disorder and antisocial. This is another one where people, okay, when they say psychopath, yeah, it's either borderline or antisocial. These are the people that go out and commit mass murders. There's just, I think there's a really high connection between, and I want to see more data on this, but I'm not completely, you know, sure on it, between the development of these disorders and attachment styles to the parents, particularly mothers and the father figure, but they need to be analyzed separately. Sometimes the problem is they only assess, in a lot of these studies of attachment, they only assess attachment to the mothers. But I think that a lack of a male father figure, because we find in other data that only assesses, like, for example, how attachment to a father figure affects psychology. Ooh, I think that there's a very real possibility that the people who are a little bit more prone to some of these very destructive personality disorders had improper relationships or attachment to the father figure, particularly the violent personality disorders. That's just a guess, though. Again, I don't have any. That's a speculation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I also think the same might apply to skeptics.
Yeah, well, I think that applies to a lot of people on the left. And
yeah, it's a good one because they call themselves centrist. Yeah.
Oh, what? That's an absurdity too. That, like, you can call yourself a centrist all you like, but if all of your politics, if your politics are identical to leftists in every way except for feminism is doo doo, you're a leftist. I'm sorry. That's just my opinion on that.
Okay. Here's another question: is ADHD overdiagnosed?
It was. It's actually come down. Autism is probably being overdiagnosed now. But it's because particularly in the DSM-V, the diagnosis was made much more broad than it used to be. But essentially what happens is you have something called med student syndrome or psych student syndrome, in that in the 90s and the late 80s, ADHD and ADD were, I'm not going to say, I guess in vogue isn't really portraying it correctly, but they were being researched for the first time in depth. And so every psychology student had to learn about this new phenomena of ADD and ADHD. And what happens is that when they get out of, there's med training as a psychiatrist, they've just heard so much about it that they start seeing it everywhere. And as a result, you get overdiagnosis. Now,
yeah,
again,
and this
that's
is the thing about to the man with a hammer, everything is a nail, sort of thing.
Right. And as it became less in vogue, less popular, then, which is, again, not the best way to describe it, but as it became less of a hot topic, it walked back. And now then autism became a big thing that was being researched. And I think that's now being understood a little bit more thoroughly. But it just happens. Okay. It happens in medicine as well. When something, a new disease, I mean, like, it's a little bit different because medicine, usually you can find it. But, what's a good one? Fibromyalgia, which we can't really see, essentially, from my understanding of it. But when fibromyalgia started to be studied a lot, all of a sudden the diagnosis rate skyrockets.
Mm. Yeah. Okay. Here's a very interesting question. I'm a wee bit distracted by the chat. I am
That's
listening.
Fine.
I don't want to miss any questions because the chat moves so fast. Okay. Do you think it is a bad idea for the do you think it's bad for the development of boys at school that they are being taught largely by women as opposed to men, male teachers?
I think potentially. I think... It's, and because we see that women, well, we know this. Again, I talked, you know, about how we're tribalistic. We're tribalistic within our own. I think at one point, not necessarily was it a bad thing because the female teachers in historically probably, although they treated girls and boys differently, it wasn't in a way that was harmful to boys, which it definitely is now. We're seeing this over and over again, that boys are having very low positive outlooks in even from young ages in school, where they're just not succeeding, and then they're having much lower rates of being accepted into college or completing college. Well, I mean, I don't want to, some of the pop stuff, is the pop stories we hear definitely say that the female teachers just, they don't allow boys to, quote, be boys. They don't allow boys to express normal male behavior. Instead, it forces it forces boys to behave like girls. And that is definitely an issue. And it's probably why we have so many soy boys.
Oh dear. I mean, that phrase is so popular now, and it obviously is because it's like conservative 2 years ago was very popular because it was needed, and because there was this phenomenon and no one knew what to call it. Mm-hmm. There is an abundance of soy boys for sure. Although I know that people, that, you know, soy doesn't lower your testosterone. Apparently, that's just a harmful myth. I know, but it's still just a useful term. So
exactly,
if anyone's listening who's a fan, yeah,
it's not like saying that actually everyone who is a cuck actually enjoys watching their wife get fucked by men, other men. So, but it's a good general term to describe a phenomena.
Hmm. Okay, here's somebody asking, quite interesting, because we were talking about this before we went on air. What do you think of Jordan Peterson's explanation of the JQ in terms of evolutionary psychology?
I'm not sure, actually, of his opinion on the JQ. Is it essentially what I said, which was that the Jews look after their own because all tribes look after their own?
I don't know. I've not heard.
Yeah.
I've not had the pleasure of hearing Jordan Peterson talking about the JQ.
Yeah, so that's hard if neither one of us know it. I don't. I would imagine that was his explanation, but I can't speak to it. So.
Mm, right. Okay. Someone's saying that soy raises estrogen. I'm not sure if this is a.
It does. A myth it's or something not. Called. I'm forgetting, like phytoestrogen or something.
Yeah.
I believe, or I probably have the term incorrectly, but I think it does introduce more estrogen in the body, but I don't think the science has been completely investigated in terms of how that affects other things in men, such as male breast growth and such like that, or more feminine typified behavior. I don't know. Xenoestrogen, I guess, someone said, but yeah, I just haven't seen enough data on it to make a definitive claim.
Okay, here's an interesting question. Why do gays have higher IQs on average than heterosexuals?
You know, I've seen that, and I have no real good explanation for it. Because it would seem evolutionarily backward. I just don't have my... I don't know. It could be that if you want to go from the kind of theory that that there are like alphas, betas, omegas, that gays essentially remove themselves from the society, which allows them by not being involved in typical breeding behavior, that they're able to focus on more intellectual pursuits that are for the good of the tribe in other ways outside of pure reproduction.
Mm. Yeah. It's a strange question. I didn't actually know that. I don't know that it's true. I do remember hearing some. I actually remember reading somewhere that gay men have higher testosterone than heterosexual men, which, you know, that's very counterintuitive. I don't know if it's true or not. But it was a few years ago.
Yeah, I have no idea.
All right. Okay, here's an interesting question. And this is obviously sort of tongue-in-cheek. Why do academics hate the ethnostate?
Well, academia has been very thoroughly infiltrated by Frankfurt School Marxist thought, which is basically for the goal of globalization, and therefore is antithetical to the idea of the ethnostate. That would be the simplest answer, is that these are the people who are also taught that diversity is our strength, and they've been taught it since the academy was invaded by Marxist thought in the 60s and 50s. Mm. So I would say, yeah, that's... And it's, even if you go purely into STEM, unfortunately, you still have to take these general electives. And if you look at the way it is now in schools, you have to take these all of these diversity quota courses that force you to learn about how white people are evil. So, and then what happens is out of this, you get the next generation of academics who go on, and not just academics, but all kinds of teachers, you know, elementary school teachers all go, they go to college, get teaching degrees, and they have to take plenty of diversity quota training courses. They have to continue to be trained, maintain their teaching licenses. It's become so ubiquitous in all levels of education that it's cyclical at this point, unless something very massive changes it. And I think we are headed towards a major change in the cultural zeitgeist, but it's going to have to be a major one.
Yeah. One thing I would say about this is that if you're in an environment like that, the easiest way to get by is to simply adopt or internalize those ideas so that you don't have to consciously fake them anymore. And so at that point, it's going to become difficult to, you know, switch them off at the appropriate time or behind closed doors, because it's just going to become habit, in other words. So you will actually become, you know, a libtard.
Right. Well, exactly. Because there's cognitive dissonance is a term that, you know, people throw around a lot. But to understand what it really means, it is that we look to the self to understand our own our beliefs. We look to past behavior to understand what we think and what we're doing now. So if I find myself in having to again and again and again write papers that talk about how you know, diversity is our strength and it's not okay to be white and this type of libtard shit, and you do it again and again, then in the future, when you're asked a question about how do you feel about, or like, is it okay to be white? Well, maybe you're just going to look back at what you did in the past as an explanation for what you're going to, how you're going to respond and behave at the current moment. And in fact, when you're faced with a situation where your past behaviors and past beliefs don't line up with your current behavior or current beliefs, that's cognitive dissonance. It's a feeling of psychological discomfort. It actually feels uncomfortable and potentially painful to be faced with the fact that what we've done in the past and what we're doing now are incongruous.
Right, yes. Here's a question from somebody. He's asking it for largely personal reasons, apparently. So I don't know if you'll be able to answer it, but here it is. Does ADHD medication have long-lasting damaging effects?
I don't honestly know. A lot of medication can have long-lasting damaging effects. You're putting a foreign substance into your body. You know, any kind of foreign substance, well, I mean, not everything is a foreign substance, I guess, but you're putting a chemical into your body that affects it, that affects your mind in some way. So just like if you drink all day, every day, that's going to have long-term effects, pretty much. I don't have any, you know, definitive, I don't have a study, but my guess would be, yeah, absolutely. You know, any kind of medicine is going to, like, for example, if you take antidepressants for a long period of time, you can become resistant to them. You take any medication for a long period of time, you can not only become resistant, but it can have,
I mean, I took antidepressants a long time ago, 10 years ago now. Well, no, 9 years ago. But that was only for like, I don't know, 6 months or a year, as I recall. And, you know, this is a thing, and maybe you'll have something to say about this. What do you think about antidepressants?
I was pretty messed up before I was on them. I was, you know, I had I have bipolar, so I have to take lithium, which absolutely does mess you up over time, and they do have to increase your dose on that. And if you go look at how they used to use lithium to treat this, you know, bipolar 100 years ago, after a while, people get over treatment and they get what's called lithium shakes. Now, it happens. I mean, like, I have small lithium shakes, but it just makes you shaky. And you have to combine that with an antidepressant. That works for me. It doesn't work for everybody. And, you know, maybe I've tried to do other stuff. I tried to do, they said do the exercise and that kind of thing. It didn't work for me, but this works okay. So I think that you have to make that choice for yourself of what are you willing to sacrifice and what are you willing to accept the fact that you are putting essentially poison into your body on some level?
Yeah, I mean, what I would say about it is that it's not a permanent solution. You know, it's something to, it's like a life raft, and to get you through the worst of it. If you're perpetually depressed, even after you've changed your life and all that, then, well, that's another matter.
But right.
I think, yeah, that's what I would say about it. Just as somebody who's been through it, I'm certainly not qualified, but, you know, in any medical capacity, but as someone who's done it, yeah, I think it's just something to get you through the worst of it. And there's no shame in that, you know, because your brain is malfunctioning during the worst of depression.
There's a couple things. Like, bipolar is a genetic disorder. We can find the hereditary link for bipolar. So my mother has bipolar. My aunt has bipolar. My grandfather had bipolar. It's just run. It's this German side of the family are all fucked up. What a surprise. But it is a chemical imbalance that you can't really. I don't know if you can treat it. My uncle was able to do it. He was able to, over time, get himself off and be okay without medication. But yeah, I think it depends. And maybe it's your own fortitude too. I don't know. I'm just not, for me, it helps. Maybe at some point, if I'm in a better place, I could try to make enough life changes that I wouldn't need to be reliant on it to feel normal. But yeah, you're still poisoning yourself.
Okay. Make a decision, I guess. Yeah, it is a difficult one. Okay, here are two final questions. Mm-hmm. Do you think that scientific papers get censored due to peer pressure or social political pressure?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, look at Charles Murray. Absolutely. He was a Nobel Prize winner, and now he's a complete pariah. Just for saying, for doing basic, you know, sociological research. And it's not just him, it's all kinds of people. You see this all the time get censored. Normally what they'll do, well, first, there's a couple of elements here. First is that for many types of studies, you need to have, and particularly medical studies, you need to have funding in the very first place to be able to do that. But let's say you're doing a pure social science study where you don't need funding to do it. I can do it with undergrads from a class, right? It still has to go through what's called an institutional review board, or IRB. And the IRB is going to check for things like the idea that this study that you're conducting is in no way going to harm participants. And you have to give them a little bit of information on what the study is about. And it is very likely, I would guess, I've never submitted anything to the IRB that would have had any, let's say, racial component to it. But my guess would be that if you sent it to the review board and they found it distasteful, that alone, and that's the very start. This is the start of, you haven't even conducted the research yet, but then it manages to get through the IRB. So I conduct my research. And then I have to send it to a journal. Now, in social science, there's problems with journals. Even though double-blind peer review, there's still problems. Actually, JF and I were supposed to talk about this at one point. We still should. But the problems with publishing and bias in it. There's all sorts of issues between people. Even though it's blind, they can still tell you're writing. They know what you're researching. And they're going to turn you down either because they just don't like the data, which is completely antithetical to science. But unfortunately, that's the reality, you know, is that someone can say, a journal reviewer can read your study and say, I just don't like, now they can't say it exactly like this. They'll come up with an excuse, correct? And say something about this is incorrect. And then you can't get it published anywhere. And if you can't get it published in a respectable journal, then, I mean, you can publish it online, but then it's not considered, you know, true science. This is a major problem with scientific research. And yeah, absolutely. It means that if you're trying to do research on something that's a taboo topic, like race, that very unlikely you're going to be able to do that unless you have some big credentials, really, to get through it.
Okay. There are some other questions have come through, so I'll ask you them quickly and then we'll get to the last one. considering your dismissal, I don't know what this refers to, by the way. Mm-hmm. Considering your dismissal of Master Sargon, are you more of a feminist or an alt-right fangirl?
Hmm? I'm sorry, you kind of, I couldn't hear you for a second. What was, I heard something about Sargon and then fangirl.
Yeah. Considering your dismissal of Master Sargon, are you more of a feminist or an alt-right fangirl?
Well, I'm not a feminist, and I don't know when I've, well, I guess, have I dismissed Sargon? I just am not a major, I'm just not a big fan. I disagree with him a lot. That's it. I guess, if I'm given a dichotomy, or I guess alt-right fangirl is more accurate than feminist, but I don't know.
Right, okay. All right. Someone asks about the psychological effects of porn.
Yeah, it does appear that it probably has some negative effects. That looking at, but it's with anything. If you overdose on something, yeah, it's probably not healthy. You should probably get human interaction. It's not a replacement for physical contact. So, or normal human relationships. And I think that sometimes it can create that kind of effect. I have not read the studies on it. There's a ton of research on how porn affects the psyche. But I think that in small amounts, it's probably okay. Just don't overdose on it.
Right. Okay. And then, this is another, we touched on this earlier. Is it true that the education system is now catered to the way females learn and completely dismisses the way males learn, i.e. practically?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's very much, male learning of being more hands-on and stuff is dismissed in terms of, so much of this, it's why we see that girls are consistently testing higher and higher, because it is addressed more to females who are more talking oriented. Women want to talk things out. Men want to experience stuff, work with objects. We can actually see the difference in this from, I believe it's 3-day old infants, in that infants basically directly out of the womb, male infants respond faster to objects and female infants respond faster to faces. It's just a clear difference. And this has to do with learning as well. Women learn socially, men learn, practically. Yes. And that is how the system works, is through socialization, which is probably part of the reason why we're seeing these negative effects in education.
Right. Okay. So someone asks, should schools be gender segregated?
Potentially. However, yeah, potentially. There is probably some benefit towards male and female interaction, particularly during childhood. But I don't know exactly. I don't have a specific study on that one either. But it is because it helps particularly young children learn male and female roles, typical roles. But now that's being, we're told that's not correct. And children are being disincentivized from engaging in the type of... So, for example, normally in a kindergarten, traditionally in a kindergarten, where, you're taking care of very young children, the girls can interact in their social behavior, but also have some experiences between male and female. It's one of the first differences they recognize. One of the first things about the sense of the self that forms is sexual identity, gender identity. For older students, I don't know. It might be beneficial in some ways, but I think it would be less beneficial to break up schools than it would be to just have teachers and design of the course be such that it allows for different types of learning.
Right. Okay. Sorry. Clover Rock, what's the question? I don't know what question you're wanting me to answer. But anyway, somebody else asked, hold on a second. Oh yeah. Do you think that the skeptic community's intellectual credibility, integrity has been destroyed by Kraut and Tea?
Yep. I think it's the whole thing. The landscape has changed utterly after this, and it's not over either. So, because apparently this hasn't ended, but Yeah, absolutely. I think that because he had become or been had painted himself and been painted by a lot of people as the intellectual heavyweight of the skeptosphere, which was, you know, and I don't know why as a high school dropout you would do that, but I guess he got lucky. And it's sort of why I kept telling him, you don't want to push this when you don't have the academic acumen to really be this intellectual heavyweight you like to paint yourself as. And, you know, I the entire time I said to him, you're going to destroy your channel. You're going to kill yourself. And there it is. Well.
Yeah. A lot of people try to discourage him. You know, the thing is, I do think that he is intelligent. It's not.
Oh, yeah.
Some people go to town, you know, making fun of him and all this. I think he is intelligent, but he's obviously got some problem. I mean, I don't think that what he's done, I don't think that would happen to a psychologically normal person.
No,
I don't think a psychologically normal person would get into this obsession, this fixation, and even disregard the evidence that that fixation is doing him harm. You know, this is over a matter of months. You know, if it were over a matter of days, I could understand. I think a normal person would realize pretty quickly, okay, this isn't good for me. This isn't tactically good or strategically good. So they would stop.
Yeah.
But he went on for months.
And I think
that points to
though
that it wasn't going to do him any good.
Well, you reached out to him. I reached out to him. Ryan Folk reached out to him. JF reached out to him. It didn't matter. And I just saw it on Twitter, Vernaculus, who's one of the skeptics, told him to stop. And he just didn't listen to anybody. It had become, some kind of weird Ahavian obsession that was very misplaced.
Yeah, that's what I mean. That's why I think that he's not... I think he's got some kind of... I think he's not quite a normal guy. And I don't mean that to condemn him. I just think that he's got an issue that he... in himself that he needs to address. He needs to be... to become aware of it. Obviously, there is a lot that could be said about this incredible clusterfuck that's unfolding. Aiden has gone through a lot already, and I don't really like the idea of, you know, interrogating you on it here.
Oh, no. And I think, afterwards you'll be talking with Jean-Francois Garipé, who is much closer to the center of this than I am. My whole thing is I just feel, I truly felt pity to see someone who had built up something, just set themselves on fire. It made me honestly very sad, obviously. Mm. And I don't like seeing people commit suicide. I mean, like, whether, you know, academic suicide, or in this case, channel suicide, career suicide. But it did teach me a lesson on showing compassion to people. So I'm a little black-pilled on that right now.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a shame. Well, okay, here are two final questions.
Mm-hmm.
And, right, so this is related to something you said earlier. How can we make taboo areas of research more legitimate for funding and peer review and publishing? Does this require establishing new parallel institutions that are uncorrupted by prevailing ideology?
Yeah, get rid of journals. Get rid of journals altogether and have basically... I mean, journals can still exist, but make it so that this can happen all online and totally anonymously, so that, you know, if I have research that I've conducted, now we still have the problem of the IRB, and that's going to be very hard to get around, because we need to have some of this stuff, we need to have an IRB that prevents participants from being harmed. Before we had the IRB, you had things like the Milgram experiment, right, where people actually believed that they had killed another person. When they did post study examinations and questionnaires with the participants, some of them were deeply disturbed. They thought they had actually murdered someone for years after the fact. That's why we have an IRB, or it's why we, even though actually Zimbardo's Stanford prison study did go through IRB, it was a very early IRB. We need these to prevent participants from being injured, which is why you can't do stupid things like knock out genes in humans. That's incredibly unethical. So that's a question about how do we collect the data. But if we already have the data, so say meta-analysis data, that kind of stuff should absolutely be just put out in the public sphere and allowed for everyone to assess it and do peer review of them, their own volition. I think that would seriously help with getting rid of some of the extreme bias we find in academia. Now, it's so entrenched, and so it's such a long history of this. It's probably not going to happen. But that would be, getting rid of the journals would probably help.
Right, okay. And another thing I wanted to add, this is from me, because based on something you said earlier, you said that you think there is a major change in the cultural zeitgeist approaching. Mm-hmm. Could you elaborate on that?
Well, I think that the rise of alt-right and white identitarianism is indicative of that. The left has pushed this stuff so far that I think that it's reached a boiling point. And it's not, I mean, the U.S. is in a better state than a lot of countries in Europe. But, I mean, look at the multiple, nationalities that are springing up in Europe in response to it. Look at Poland. They're not going to stand by for this. That's a major change. So I don't know what's going to happen either. Yeah, accelerated so Europe burns and start over. Or people are going to, I think it's going to come to potentially fighting at this point. I don't know what else. It's at a bad place, but there's definitely a change. People are tired of it.
Yeah, I agree. I think there is a need for something new because the inadequacies of the current paradigm are just becoming glaringly obvious now.
Mm-hmm.
I think really the state of academia sort of embodies that.
Oh yeah, definitely.
All right. Okay. Well, I don't think there are any other questions. So, do you want to just end it here?
Yeah, sounds good.
Okay. Well, this has been a very enjoyable and interesting conversation, and I'm glad that you agreed to come on the channel and make an appearance.
Yeah, it was fun.
It was so many questions from people, because once they know they're speaking to somebody who knows about this stuff, lots of things come up.
Mm-hmm.
So, all right. Oh, someone's asking, what do you think of Common Core?
Oh, God. I did a video on it. It's absolutely reprehensible and needs to be done away with.
You hear these horror stories, even, across the Atlantic about Common Core, and I don't know if it's been exaggerated and if the things I hear about it are representative, or if it's just like some teacher has taken it all too far, or if it's actually in the
it's in the workbooks. It's in like the actual manuals that are given to teachers. So yeah. No, it does vary from state to state and district to district, but some of the things I've seen are inexcusable.
Hmm. Okay. All right. Well, let's leave it at that. So this was Aidan Paladin, or how is it pronounced?
Aidan Paladin. Yeah.
Paladin. Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much for appearing. The next one is with, I think, is it JF away, or is it someone else first? I can think so. And that'll be in, it's Rad Russ next. And that'll be in about half an hour from now. And then JF will be 2 hours after that. So, and I guess we will speak fairly extensively about the Kraut thing then. So, mm-hmm. All right. Okay, well, thank you, Aidan.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
It was a pleasure. And thanks, everyone, for listening. I'll see you in about half an hour. Bye for now.